This is Ozarks at Large. It seems counterintuitive to think history can change, but certainly how we consider the past can change. Ben Johnson, the author of Arkansas in Modern America since 1930, is able to reconsider history in a way. The second edition of the book, published by the University of Arkansas Press, updates the first edition after almost two decades. Johnson, who is the John G. Ragsdale Jr. and Dora J. Ragsdale Professor of Arkansas Studies at Southern Arkansas University, was recently in Fayetteville to discuss the book, and during his time here, he came to the Carver Center for Public Radio. He says working on a second edition of a history book can be an unusual experience.
It's a rare privilege for a historian to get a do-over, because what this allowed me to do, of course, was correct mistakes in the first edition. But that length of time also allowed me to take advantage of much of the fabulous work that other historians have been doing in terms of publishing articles or delivering presentations. So I was exploiting the work and the research of my colleagues, and I could incorporate that into the new edition. And secondly, we could argue that Arkansas has changed and developed perhaps in unexpected ways in the 20 years between 2000 and 2019. What that means is that I have to go back and kind of reevaluate what I said earlier because the context and your perspective changes because of what's happened in the past two decades. But then there's the obvious that I simply include all the new things that have happened, the new developments, and somehow hope that fits in with the older narrative.
The second edition kind of picks up at the end, I mean, is a time period that picks up at the end of the Clinton presidency, right?
Right. The first edition in 2000, it was at the end of the Clinton presidency. And it did include, of course, discussions of the Whitewater scandals as well as what he had accomplished in the second term. But again, there was really little in the 21st century at all. Pretty much the book had been finished by 1998, 1999, and published in 2000.
How, when you're, and I don't know, I didn't do the page count, it's about 350 or so. You're talking about Arkansas since 1930. You know there are things that you have to examine, address, and look, Central High, electrification, things like that, the dams. I would imagine the tougher part is maybe the second or third tier and how events or phenomena and how they tie in to history. And what do you put in and what can't make it into 350 pages?
That's a wonderful question, and it certainly was a struggle throughout this. This book was part of the Histories of Arkansas series. It was the third volume to come out when it was published in 2000. The previous volumes had covered Arkansas from the territorial period to the Civil War, and then from the 1870s till 1930. Because in those books, there's been certainly lots of work done both in the United States. There's a framework. In other words, those are familiar periods of time in which historians deal with, and you kind of know what to look for. Understandably, when you begin to look at contemporary history, which is what this book did, there is not as many signposts. Mm-hmm. And you're correct. It becomes a little bit more difficult to determine based on what other contemporary histories of the South or the contemporary histories of the United States have highlighted. Again, it's a little bit more amorphous. So what I decided to do in this book, both in the first edition and in the second, was to try to come up with a coherent narrative that provided as much as possible a full and comprehensive portrait of the state. What that meant was that the book would include attention to politics and economics, and economics would be, of course, from agriculture to industry. It would look at social developments. It would look at civil rights. It would look at gender history. It would look certainly at culture, including literature and music. The problem, of course, was to somehow put all of those pieces, which really don't fit naturally, into a narrative. My aim was to make the narrative as seamless as possible. So what gets included or gets left out is what, or for lack of a better term, contributes to the coherence of the narrative. And so at this point, it sounds more like I'm trying to be a novelist than a historian, but perhaps there's some overlap there as well. And yes, it was a struggle what to include and what to leave out. Some things, you're correct, you had to include. The Little Rock 1957 crisis and civil rights. Earlier would be the Great Depression and rural electrification, which is that's been some new work done on that, but that's fascinating. You could argue, as I did, that if you consider the 1930s and the Great Depression, the most tremendous change in Arkansas is the fact that people began to get lights. Mm-hmm. It would be a long process, but it began in the 1930s. It
took a long time to get them to Ben-Hur.
Exactly, exactly. And there was, of course, political and economic struggles between the private investor companies, particularly Arkansas Power and Light, and the public power companies as well. And as you said, that was the damming of Arkansas. And that brings into the questions about the environment, changes in the environment, because you create lakes. And so in the 1930s, you basically don't have lakes. It's exaggeration. That's what I'm good at. But you don't have lakes in Arkansas in the 1930s. But by the time we're coming to the 21st century, you got lakes. And those dams, which perhaps were mainly for flood control and hydroelectric, they also become very, very important to the tourism industry, which by the late 20th century into the 21st century, the tourism industry is the grand hope to help rehabilitate small towns and communities that have lost the manufacturing enterprises that had boosted their fortunes back in the 1950s and 1960s. And so that's an example which you try to tie together in a narrative.
What I love also are some of the details that have perhaps faded as decades have unspooled, including, I think it was Greer's Ferry, where there was some negotiation between bass fishermen, trout fishermen, environmentalists, politicians, the Corps of Engineers, a big deal at the time that many of us might have faded on some of the details.
Sure. That is a perfect example of dramatic changes in Arkansas. That dam was, again, Greer's Ferry, was surprisingly controversial because what it would mean is it would do away with the bass population.
Because the water would be too cold,
right? The water would be too cold. You're changing the temperature of the water when you have a dam. And the Corps of Engineers, which, of course, is the federal agency that builds dams and drains land throughout Arkansas, that was one federal agency. And, you know, from the 1940s to 1960s, everybody in Arkansas loved. That was not controversial as opposed to, say, civil rights enforcement. Corps of Engineers, they were making the state better. They're bringing electricity. They're bringing lakes and tourists. But that dam, in some ways, was one of the early inklings of a burgeoning environmental movement because you were going to lose the fish. And the Corps was facing opposition. And the compromise, as you said, was, okay, we're going to let go of the native species, but we can introduce trout, which will flourish. Now, by introducing trout, as you know, trout will not spawn naturally. You got to keep introducing trout year after year after year. But that compromise was at least it won out, and the dam was built. And it was, of course, at Greer's Ferry where you had that sort of memorable scene, the dedication in which President John Kennedy delivered the speech. It was also at the same point that Orville Faubus, the governor of Arkansas at that point, delivered essentially a rebuke to the president over his civil rights measures. And that was in October of 1963, 1 month before President Kennedy was assassinated.
I'm glad you brought up President Kennedy's visit because he said something. You have him quoted something that I think is very interesting about Arkansas in the middle part of the century when he's talking pound for pound. The Arkansas Legislative Coalition was the strongest in the country. You had Fulbright, McClellan, Wilbur Mills, wasn't he head of Ways and Means in Congress? Mm-hmm. You had Senate Foreign Relations. I mean, it was a strong group for a small, poor state.
Exactly. People of a certain age, mine, would remember, of course, that power. I think probably they may surprise, what you just said may very surprise, may well surprise many of your listeners about the political clout of Arkansas. It had even gone earlier in the 1930s when you had Senator Joseph T. Robinson, who was a Senate Majority Leader. And Arkansas not only had very powerful members, because in Congress at that point, seniority is what were the avenues to power. And in Arkansas, we got into a rut, and we elected the same people time after time after time after time. But I don't want to indicate that they were just simply people who lasted and endured and had no talents. Senator Fulbright and Senator McClellan, who were contrasting approaches to power, but those two men were exceptionally talented. Wilbur Mills, the father, if you will, of Medicare, was, again, an adroit, wonderful legislator. So they were very, very, very capable, but they also had seniority. The other thing is, and this perhaps would surprise your younger listeners, a little bit earlier than that point, Arkansas at one point, up until the 1950s, had 7 members in the House of Representatives. Of course, we have only 4 now, and that was because Arkansas had that population. And so thus, what began to change over the years was the retirement or death or the election loss of those powerful figures, and also the fact that the Arkansas delegation shrank. But yes, what you said would surprise many people today. Arkansas wielded a great deal of clout and influence in Congress several decades ago.
Representation shrank because population shrank?
The population did shrink, which is remarkable. People perhaps don't think it is, but in Arkansas, in absolute terms, lost population in the 1940s and 1950s. The reason is that people left. And as people drained out of Arkansas, that meant that the representation in the House of Representatives, of course, declined as well. And beyond that, well, that's just simply one example. Beyond that, the flow of people out of Arkansas in those years is one of the remarkable parts of the Arkansas story. It's hard to measure because what you're saying is that people left, that's important, that changed the state. It's difficult to say how it did change the state, because what would have been Arkansas if people had stayed? And that's almost too imaginative. We do know certain things, that the exodus of African Americans from the Delta, who basically made their lives better and who took the opportunity to leave and advance their families. But the leaving of African American families from the Delta, of course, took away the reliable labor pool for large landowners and essentially did away with the old-fashioned plantation, and helped also to move those landowners and farms away from cotton toward other more profitable crops. So you can look at some things very definitely as institutions changed when people left, but the full aspect, it can only be, you know, guessed at. But it's one of the remarkable stories. And if you talk to of Arkansans of a certain age and begin to inquire and talk about their lives, that matters. In other words, they had family members who left. They had neighbors. They had friends who left. And that back and forth shaped many lives at a very basic level for Arkansans.
I'm wondering, after writing this and then coming back for the second edition, do you feel like there is an Arkansan story? I mean, because you're talking from El Dorado to Lake Village to Paragould to Northwest Arkansas and everything in between. Or did it make you think that it's even harder to come up with some sort of one-size-fits-all Arkansan narrative?
Well, the truth is, as you suggest, there's not one-size-fits-all. However, and this is one good reason for beginning a book like this in the 1930s. In the 1930s, there was a very conscious attempt by prominent leaders, both political and also business leaders, to help forge an Arkansas identity. And there were basically two ways this was done. One was using New Deal dollars, a New Deal federal program that was designed to help Americans get back on their feet. But it also provided monies to promote cultural recognition to promote history, and this was important in Arkansas. So in Arkansas, we will have, for the first time, really a grand birthday party, the 1936 centennial. And what we're saying, what I'm trying to say there, is that Arkansas, for the first time, has a very public birthday party. Franklin Roosevelt comes to Little Rock and delivers a speech. But throughout that year of 1936, the centennial year of statehood, throughout that year, you have communities and towns, and they'll have historic festivals. They'll have historic pageants. I mean, the whole state gets involved in celebrating what? Arkansas history. And you also begin to detect, it's very clear, again, helped by New Deal funding and subsidies, the celebration of the people in the Ozarks, the hill people. To treasure their music, to treasure their stories. Those music and stories are being collected, and those music and stories become the center of folk festivals and so forth. And so increasingly, and this is a bit subjective, but I have suggested it in the first edition, and the extraordinary historian Brooks Blevins has looked at this in his work on the Ozarks. But quite simply, the Ozark, quote, hillbilly, now becomes a figure who celebrated for his or her independence, for his or her refusal to go along with fashion, that they're no longer an insular people, but they are devoted to family and kinship and will defy any sort of attempt to change their ways. That's a popular idea. It's not true, but it's a popular idea. And so those qualities of independence and persistence and reliability, they also become Arkansas qualities. And so as a sometimes say to people, if you think about, if I say the word Arkansan, you think about what that's like. That was likely shaped through these cultural projects in the 1930s. Because before the 1930s, you have to remember, this is a state that has wildly different sections. You've just said it. Yeah. I mean, you've got from Eldorado to Stuttgart to Blytheville to, of course, Mountain Home, Fort Smith, and so forth. It's a small state with diverse economies and diverse ecologies. And it was a small state that for, of course, a very long time didn't have transportation routes. It's hard to get around in it. So you didn't really have much of a concept of Arkansas, arguably. But in the 1930s, you begin to see how important that is, and it begins to be embraced. And it begins to pick up. For example, I mentioned after World War II, the creation of the Arkansas Razorbacks. They become a state.
Right.
They become a statewide phenomena. You have the Razorback radio network, so now people far from Fayetteville can listen to the games. Fayetteville was hard to get to, even in the 1940s.
It wasn't that easy in the early 1980s.
Even. No. Well, you talk about from my part of the world to travel from Lower Arkansas to Fayetteville would take 8 or 9 hours, even with the highways, by car, 8 or 9 hours. Well, by 1950, you had War Memorial Stadium in Little Rock. So that made the Arkansas Razorbacks truly a state-centered sort of athletic event. And the devotion, of course, just picked up. Well, that's a way in which you begin to bind the state. So there are many ways in which you can say, yes, this is how Arkansas became Arkansas. I think it began in the 1930s. If you're asking me now in the 21st century, that becomes different. Mm-hmm. And one way of approaching that question is to note that people in Arkansas are still leaving. The population continues to grow. But that practice of out-migration, of going to different places, that continues. The population grows because people move in. And what we have in the 21st century is this to and fro. You've got people leaving Arkansas. You have people coming into Arkansas. You have people leaving rural areas, coming into the cities. So there's a great – I mean, this notion that Arkansas people stay put, or as we might say in lower Arkansas, you know, stay close to mama, that's not happening. And with that continuing sort of churn in demographics and new people always arriving – it becomes difficult to say, well, this is who an Arkansan is, because you're talking about people who've not been here for very long. And I think that whole notion of an Arkansas, Central Arkansas sort of character or quality or distinction has become, not surprisingly, in the 21st century, a little bit dissipated.
Ben Johnson is the author of Arkansas in Modern America since 1930. The second edition has just been published by the University of Arkansas Press. He is the John G. Ragsdale Jr. and Dora J. Ragsdale Professor of Arkansas Studies at Southern Arkansas University. He came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio last week after discussing the book at the Fayetteville Public Library.